You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 1. Time is repeating itself. Oh no! What, 2010? When did we start this show?
I think it was June 2010.
Yeah, it's 2010. I assume that means that Obama is president and everything is rosy. And
are you trapped in 2010, Adam?
The super nuke. I don't really remember what happened in 2010.
I'm a freshman in college.
Ricky is young and sexy and not all haggard and gross like he is now.
I went to my first Melvin show.
Melvin shit happened. Actually, neither of you were on this podcast. Yeah, it was It was a great time for everyone. Yeah, all right. So what is this? This is episode 392. It is 392 of the Punk News Podcast. My name is Adam White. We're heard of you here in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Joining me, you heard Mr. Ricky Frankel out in Los Angeles.
Hey, guys.
Hello, Ricky. And Mr. John Gentile out in parts unknown, East Coast.
East Coast, baby. Oh, yeah. Jersey Shore.
Yeah, just like the Bouncing Souls song, word for word. Anyway, so we're going to talk about a bunch of news stories and things that happened tonight, stories and happenings and this and that from the website punknews.org and elsewhere on the internet. Before we go, John, you always scribble us a few little show notes before we get into the thick of it. And this one is I'm curious how these two thoughts connect.
Oh, they don't.
They don't. Okay. I was trying to figure out why. So John, can I read what you've written here, or is it going to spoil you? Okay. So John has written in our schedule, John saw Harley Flanagan / is mad at Ian MacKay and Dan Yemen. So I was like, all right, what did they do to poor Harley? He's so innocent. John, what are you talking about?
Well, first of all, I saw Harley. I've been wanting to see Harley Flanagan for about 3 or 4 years now. He really plays almost no shows at all. He just put out his first album in a long time last year called the album called I Come in Peace, or is it called? It's either called I Come in Peace or Trust. It's called Trust No One, and it is I think without question, it's the second best Cro-Mags related album. After Age of Quarrel. I mean, it is great. It's only like 20 minutes long. The songs are all like a minute and a half, super hard. It's basically Age of Quarrel without the Hare Krishna stuff. It's just, you know, just the Harley Flanagan, you know, beat down kind of stuff. So anyways, I've been wanting to see him for a while now. And he announced like a 4-day tour or 3-day tour. And he was playing like all these weird places. And he was playing, he didn't play Philadelphia for some reason, but he played not in Baltimore, but like outside of Baltimore, this place called the Fishhead Cantina, which was like kind of like a sushi place, except for it was also kind of like a dive bar. And it was just like new but grimy, which is a new thing I don't think I've ever seen. I don't think I've seen a place that is new and grimy at the same time. So anyways, Striper's playing there next week. So anyways, Harley Flanagan was there. And first of all, Harley Flanagan, not as big as I thought he was. He's not a gigantic guy. And I don't say that to disparage him. I said to compliment him because we don't need to reiterate them. But the tales of Harley Flanagan's scuffles are known far and wide. And I believe them. And the fact that he's gotten that many scuffles and he's not a gigantic guy makes him that much cooler, if you ask me. So he did a solo set. I'm not interested in inflaming anything, but people know that Harley and John Joseph do not like each other. John Joseph's sets are basically Age of Quarrel and Crush the Demonaic and maybe a Bad Brains cover. And it's kind of like the same set every time. And it's cool. It's cool. I've seen the Cro-Mags with John Joseph without Harley, I think 4 times or maybe even 5 times. It's definitely cool. It's definitely worth seeing. Harley kind of, I guess, in reaction to that, he doesn't have a set list and he does stuff from throughout his discography. And first of all, Harley is so intense. I mean, Harley is he's crazy. Like, Harley Live is awesome. A couple of unexpected things is the post-Age of Quarrel stuff, when played live, sounds a lot more like the Age of Quarrel stuff than it does on the record, which helps, you know. The second Cro-Mags album is called Best Wishes. For me, it's very hit or miss. Live, those songs are much, much better. They're much rawer and nastier. And also, the weird thing is, while I was there, he doesn't have a set list, and I kind of wish he did, because I think it might have made the show, I guess, a little bit more of a set piece, if you will. But to be fair, because he had no set list, it definitely made it raw and definitely made it very exciting. He said, "So what do you guys want to hear?" And people were like yelling out like mid-period Cro-Mags stuff. I was like, wow, I thought you guys would be on Age of Quarrel, nothing but people wanted the mid-period stuff, which surprised me, and it was awesome live. I mean, I really highly recommend seeing Harley live. It was crazy, and it was great. A couple of interesting things is, before the show, he was talking to some guy, and this lady says to him, "Harley, Harley, Harley," and I don't know how he did it, but he, like, pointed to the guy that he was talking to, and, like, with his other hand, like, made, like, the talking motion with his hand. You guys know what I mean?
Yeah.
And kept talking to the guy. I don't know how he did it. He was saying, "Oh, I can't talk to you right now. I'm talking to this guy." And then she goes, "Harley, you have to talk with me. I've got boobs." And Harley says one of the coolest things I think I've ever heard anyone say ever. Just matter-of-factly, he says, "I'm married, so no boobs." And he keeps talking to the guy. I was like, damn. So anyway, after the show, I got his book. I was glad I did. And while he sells stickers that is just his face, like life size, like Scally, which is hilarious. So after the show, he's signing books. I bought a book and he signs the book. And I was like, "Oh, Harley," "I interviewed you once and it was cool." And he's like, "So who should I make the book out to?" I was like, "John." So he signs it. And there's like all this like red stuff on it, on the book when he's signing it. I'm like, "That's weird. That must be like residue from the stickers or whatever." So I go home, I open up my book, and I realize it's blood. My book is covered in Harley Flanagan's blood. So honestly, I think it's pretty cool.
But yeah, on the other hand,
I don't want to touch Harley Flanagan's
DNA
blood.
Sample's not really necessary.
The guy's been through some stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I was just thinking of anyone I know, you are the one who would be most likely to have like a creepy secret DNA bank of various punkers in your basement somewhere. It's one of these things where you walk into a room and it's full of vials, and each vial has like has a piece of tape on it where you've like drawn the band logo and then like in the corner there's maybe like a big jar full of bubbles that has like a just like a horrific dead mutant that the clone didn't work, just kind of floating in there. That's I picture you could have that.
I'll take that as a compliment. Thank you, Adam. So anyway, Harley Flanagan, I've got his blood. He was awesome live. And his book is fantastic. I'm going to do a review. I highly recommend seeing Harley Flanagan live. It was cool. Meanwhile, I'm mad at Ian McKay and Dan Yemin. I'm actually not mad at Ian McKay, but like everything Ian McKay does, or McKay, everything Ian McKay does is everyone else takes it to the extreme and completely mutilates it and perverts it from what it was supposed to be. So the big thing about Fugazi was how much their shows cost.
Like $8, right? Or $5?
$5. Fugazi was famous for their $5 shows, and that was in 1988, and that was because they were selling 2,000 tickets. You know, so when you have that many people coming in, you can charge low and still make a good amount of money. Somehow, punks have taken the concept that money should not dictate what art is to punks shouldn't get paid for doing art. You know, it's not quite the same thing. And also, even though that was 30 years ago, literally, punks still think a show should cost $5. And you know, we're throwing the Punk New Summer Slam down April 7. I was going to charge $10 for that, and I almost definitely did. I charged $10 for Cassie Ramon, Joe Jack Talcum, and Colleen Green, and I thought that was insanely cheap. I'm like $3.33 for Cassie, $3.33 for Joe Jack, $3.33 for Colleen. That's like insanely cheap. Like $3 for an entire set. That's like crazy. Meanwhile, people spend $8 on a beer. It turned out that was the right price for that because people bought tickets and we actually did all right money wise on that. So that was cool. That was cool. For this new one, it's Crazy in the Brains, Drew Getz, Up Up Ups, and Jade of Posers, you know, none of those are quite as famous as Colleen or Cassie or Joe Jack. And I was thinking, you know, $10, that's kind of the bottom level for a show, you know, four bands, a full night, $10. But, and I asked on the internet, I'm like, yeah, so what do people think? And people, like all the artists were like, $10, that's the fair price. That's the fair price, $10. I'm like, that's, yeah, it sounds right to me. But everyone else who wasn't actually in the band, they were like, I won't pay $10 to see a show. I pay $7, but not $10. And I'm thinking, like, you would not go to a show over $3, but the answer is people won't go to a show over $3. So I set the price at 7 to 10 sliding scale. But the reason I'm mad is, meanwhile, while I'm begging people for $7 measly dollars, Dan Yemen is throwing open city shows for $5 and making the statement that, you know, if you guys did it for $5, we'll do it for $5. And I like Dan Yemen a lot. I think Dan Yemen's great. Sometimes I feel as though people suffer the shrapnel of his good intentions, in that people see Dan Yemen charging $5 and they're like, well, if Dan Yemen charges $5, that's all a show should cost, or even less, because Dan Yemen is semi-famous. Meanwhile, I'm like, no, you don't realize that Dan Yemen is charging $5 because he's got other money and he doesn't need the money at all, you know, and he doesn't really have any expenses to cover. Meanwhile, me, who has to pay bands, who has to pay venue, who has to pay sound man, there are expenses to cover, you know. So $5 is not the going rate. $5 is the subsidized fee, making it a statement, you see. But the punkers don't understand that. And I was thinking, well, how do you rectify that? And the only way to rectify that is if everyone bands together and you know, sets a bottom price. But meanwhile, a lot of shows around the city are only charging $5. So the question is, does the market demand $5 and that basically no one gets paid ever? But to me, that's the death knell of art, because if you can't make any money and everyone's losing money, it's tough to keep doing it. So it's suffocating. Or is that abuse by the majority and some sort of ground floor should be set? The point being is $5 is too cheap for a show. $5 is way too cheap for a show. Metal starts at $18.
You know? I've been to $5 shows, and it was like in what would probably not be considered venues or legal venues. And they were like donation based, like $5 is a recommended donation. But still, to compare yourself to like to Fugazi doing that, charging $5. $5 went a lot farther in 1988 than it did today. So, and you know, standard of living has gotten cost of living has gotten higher since then. I don't know why, like, DIY shows aren't immune from inflation, even if it's like a little bit more. I mean, I think it's a little bit. I think five is a little bit low, to be honest.
Yeah, and I mean, like, there's one thing about going and trying to charge five for a show if, you know, if it's if you're already just going to go put on a show in your basement or in your backyard or something like that, and you basically have no expenses,
yeah.
Well, then sure, you can charge whatever you want, and you know, I'll see that price point a lot when it is kind of like a house show and or it's like a pay what you can kind of like super punk, you know, thing, but if it's at any sort of venue where, you know, the fact that your band is playing there is part of a relationship that involves like the commerce of that venue running and probably selling drinks and things like that, then I don't know, like $5 in these days is weirdly cheap. And I don't know if it's like, if I'm speaking too much out of privilege by thinking that's too cheap, but like,
no, Adam, you're not speaking out. If you can afford to go to a show at all, you can afford $7 or $10. You know what I mean? Like, if you can't afford $7, then you need to be working on your finances and not going to shows. You know what I mean?
Especially when when you're paying like double or triple that at normal shows for beer. I agree with John on that part.
Yeah, I mean, like $5. I mean, and again, I hate saying this because it makes it sound like money isn't an object, but $5 is nothing, right? Like five. What's a fucking pizza cost these days, right?
Yeah,
like these, 12.
Everything else is more expensive. The bands that are there playing the show, they don't get to go in like a time vortex and go back and spend that money in 1972. Like they have to pay for gas at today's prices and get their car fixed at today's prices and have all the same expenses and everything else that everyone else does. So yeah, spending more than five for a show seems just totally reasonable to me.
I agree. We all agree. The question is, can we rectify that, or is that unrectifiable?
What would drive me crazy? Like, what would drive me nuts as, like, say, like, the person working the door or something like that is, like, if you don't do five, in my head, you have to do 10.
Because if you do, that's what I was thinking.
Like, if you do eight, then what are you going to do? Everyone's, you got to have like a cash register full of
ones.
Ones. Sorry, American. Yeah. full of ones, right? And do you guys have $2 bills?
For a while.
Well, we do have $2 bills, but people don't really use them. Fun all fact, right, when I went to take the bar exam, parking was $8. And quite nicely, they had $2 bills for everybody. And I mean, I don't know if this is true in Canada. And Adam White, in America, at least sort of, $2 are considered good luck. I thought that was a nice gesture.
It was not. It's not a luck thing up here, to my knowledge. Mm. I mean, we had $2 bills. We had $1 bills, too, but we got rid of all that for coins.
You don't have $1 bills? Oh, you have coins, no, right?
Like a loony, right? We have a loony, but we have a toonie too. So we have that. And fuck, people have been eyeing the five. We should get rid of that one too.
It's like medieval England. All you have is coins on through little sacks. Adam, do you have a coin sack that you carry around tied to your rope belt?
No, I don't. But partly the reason is that, like, I don't want coins on me at all ever. So if I had to go to a show and pay $8 to get in, it means not only have to have a five, I have a five and want like a pocket full of change, at least up here, to do that. So I don't know, maybe it's different in the States, but like paying anything that isn't an even number is annoying, at least up here. I wouldn't.
I hear you, but listen, people, I mean, the people spoke. They said, listen, if you charge $10, I'm not going to go. If you charge $7, I may go, or I might go, or I will go. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not interested in losing money in order to make a statement. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, you got to pay what the market's going to bear. I just think the market's a little fucked up in that case. Like, people can pay more for a show.
So is there a way to correct people's perceptions? You know what I mean? Like, the answer is yes, because the metal community did it. You know, heavy metal starts at $16 or $18. You know, punk starts at $5.
I mean, it in a way, it kind of comes down to the bands in that case. Like, there's got to be, the bands have got to stick their neck out and decide that they're going to charge more for their shows. If they feel really good about having, like, a super punk poster for their house show that says, like, only $5, you know, ask a punk where to find it or whatever. Well, that's cool. But I mean, you can't fill your car with cool.
Or you know what? You add more people to the lineup, too.
But then you got to pay them.
Yeah, I know. So what you do is you make.
So you keep raising it. You get 100 bands, and eventually I'm charging $1,000 a ticket.
Well, I mean,
but I only need to sell one. Right. So anyway, it's tough, man. I mean, like, it's really changed. I mean, honestly, I'm glad I'm doing this, because more and more I'm getting more perspective. This is sliding scale, $7 to $10. People outside of Philadelphia seem to be, like, the concept of sliding scale seemed alien to them. I thought sliding scale was punk scene. Like, I thought everybody knew about sliding scale. You guys know about sliding scale, right?
I know about it. I've never been to a show with one. Closest I've ever come was donation-based shows.
Or maybe it's a Philadelphia thing. Adam, what, do they do sliding scale in Canada or where you live in Niagara?
I mean, not that I've seen. I mean, I've been to house shows where it's kind of like, you know, pay what you can, suggested is X,
I guess it is a Philadelphia thing then. I honestly did not realize that.
How does sliding scale work?
Yeah, I'm surprised people are surprised by this. Here's how sliding scale works: is you can pay $7, $8, $9, or $10 or more, but $7, $8, $9, or $10, and you should pay. The idea is you can pay what you can afford, but the real answer is you can pay whatever you feel like. And in that situation, I always used to pay the minimum, because my perspective was always like, listen, I'm willing to pay the bands, but I'm not going to pay more than you're asking. So whatever you think is the fair price to charge, you should charge. So I would pay the lowest out of principle, but it changed my perspective. The bad part is really, the sliding scale system benefits leeches and harms the true fans, because the true fans are willing to pay. Meanwhile, the leeches will get away with paying as little as they can. So really, the true fans suffer the detriment, and the people that aren't the true fans get the benefit. But I mean, that's just how the market is right now, you know. But the point being is, the way sliding scale works is you're supposed to be able to pay what you can afford in that range, but people usually just pay what they want. So it's interesting. I thought on sliding scale everyone paid the lowest amount, more or less. But Lita Gray, who's been pushed into the limit, Green Meter, and a couple other bands, she says most people pay the maximum. So we'll see. It'll be an interesting experiment.
Yeah.
John, you should charge us some sort of like wheel of chance.
I like that idea.
Where you show up, you spin the wheel. Maybe they get in free. Maybe they got to pay $20, right? Who knows?
You have the free one weighted a little bit more than the others.
I like that. All right. Well, anyways, listen, punks need to start paying more for shows. You know, $10 is an extremely cheap night out. A movie's like $14. So $10, if you can't pay $10 for a show, then you need to get your priorities checked, mate. You know what I'm saying?
I'm with you on that. $10 is fine.
However, I got to agree. I would always pay $10 for a show. Bad Canoes, one of my favorite bands of all time. The only reason I went is because it was a cheap ticket. Like, if it was a $15 ticket, I wouldn't have went. I think it was $8, you know, but. Anyways, Ricky plays song. Oh, no, let's do some mail. How about that?
Yeah, do that.
All right. So anyway, let me pull up the mail. As always, you can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. We love getting your mail. Mail is always good. And this is from, I believe, one of our longtime writers, longtime listeners, who's always willing to pay $10 to get into a show, even though he's from the UK. So anyway, here's what he's got to say. He's got some interesting stuff because he wrote into podcast@punknews.org.
You're really, really trying to waste some time as you open your email and search.
I should have had it ready. I usually have it ready. All right, here we go. This is from a longtime writer. And here comes the email right now. Here it is. This is from Liverpool Neil. Hello, chaps. Liverpool Neil here. I just listened to episode 389 where you talked about Mark E. Smith and The Fall. Here are some thoughts. Adam, The Fall actually had 66 official members, not 40 as you thought. John, I don't get you sometimes. I would have thought that The Fall would have been right up your alley, but as normal, you confound me. You said The Fall were just ranting over droning guitar lines. That sounds like every band you've ever said you liked. I admit that a lot of their output is repetitive and just plain annoying, but you can't ignore classics like Bingo Masters Breakout, Totally Wired, and Rouchy Rumble. And for someone that always talks about how real artists make difficult and challenging art, then they don't get much more difficult or challenging than Mark E. Smith. Pause that, Liverpool Neil. I will check out those albums. The only Fall stuff I've ever checked out really is Live from the Witch Trials, the live album from that period, and a couple other albums. But I will check those out and reassess. I'm happy to do that. Liverpool Neil continues, I knew they were very prolific, but I had no idea how much. They had 32 studio albums and over 100 live and compilation albums. Have you seen their Discogs page? It's 204 entries and counting. To put that in the context, Black Flag has 30 entries on Discogs. And finally, I don't know if you saw the story about Mark E. Smith's wake and funeral, but it's the most Mark E. Smith punk thing I've ever read. The wake for Fall legend Mark E. Smith descended into a brawl, an ex-bandmate said. He would have loved it. Guitarist Ben Pritchard said, I just about managed to escape with my life from Mark E. Smith's funeral. The ceremony itself was nice, touching in places. The wake, however, didn't last half an hour before bottles were thrown and drinks were poured over people. Total disrespect. He would have loved it. Actor Steve Evitz, who was also a guitarist with the band, said, I've got to say, it was just like a Fall gig. Some strange people there, and it kicked off. I don't think he would have had it any other way. We love you, Mark. Also, news editor features editor Adam White, who was in the Fall but didn't realize it, had the following to say. What a party. And Liverpool Neil continues. And as an angry sign, the joke being Adam White was in the Fall because it had so many members but didn't even realize it. That's the joke. Liverpool, they can't all be winners, people. Liverpool Neil continues, as an angry sign-off, this just in, Adam, leave me hanging out here on the rope. As an angry sign-off, this just in, Fugazi are a bunch of pretentious, self-important wankers. King effing Crimson, effing F right off. As normal, love you all and stay free from Liverpool Neil. Liverpool Neil coming out hard against Fugazi and King Crimson. Were we talking about King Crimson?
We talked about the band that the dudes from Fugazi started with.
That's right.
Jazz guitar, yeah. Virtuoso,
the Mesthetics.
Mesthetics, something like that. And King Crimson was mentioned in reference somewhere.
I like Fugazi, so I don't know if I watched their that instrument documentary a couple times. I didn't find them to be pretentious. I think they're just trying to do their own thing. They weren't trying to impose it on anyone. Seem like solid dude.
I'm picturing a sticker on like a copy of, you know, Red Medicine or something that says like solid dudes.
They seem like solid dudes.
Honestly, whenever a band people say like, oh, that band, they're solid dudes or best dudes or best guys or whatever, the band is usually nice people, but a very boring, mediocre band.
Fugazi.
I don't think Fugazi is mediocre or boring. Well, yeah. I don't think they're beard punk, if anything. But yeah. So anyway, Ricky, that was, you can reach that podcast at punknews.org. Ricky, play a song.
Okay, so I'm going to play a song that came out from an album that came out last year. One of our new reviewers sent in this review that got posted mid-February. And the band's called Debt Neglector. And they came out with an album called Atomic Land last year. And I totally missed it. This band is really fucking great. This is one of the main albums I've been listening to for like the last 2 or 3 weeks now. And it's got, I think it has one member of New Mexican Disaster Squad in it. I think if you like, you know, Dillinger 4, Direct Hit, I think he also, the reviewer also talked about the Copyrights Banner Pilot. You'll probably like this band. they're great in my book. So I'm going to play the song. I'm going to play Gift Shop off the off Debt Collector's album Atomic Land. Here it is.
We have a bunch of stories, things that happened, things that are going to happen that we're going to talk about. One of them, we have been, I think, like kicking the ball from episode to episode because John wasn't with us for a little while because of the incident. John, are we talking about your stay in the penitentiary there, or is this not a?
Well, listen, I've said it before and I'll say it again. Stanford Sean had it coming. He kept pushing me at him that he didn't like the Melvins. I told him don't say it. He kept saying like, you know, John, the Melvins are boring. You know, John, the Melvins are boring. Well, listen, who's boring now? You know, when you're in a full body cast and all you can eat is pea soup, that's pretty boring.
John, I can calm John down by telling him this. I don't think I've told him this yet, but I got my ticket to my first Melvin show that's happening in July.
Oh, I'm excited for you, Ricky. It'll be a great time, man. Melvins are awesome live.
Yeah, I'm stoked.
So, anyways, we keep moving this story about screaming females because John wants to talk about it. And now you're finally here. So I feel like there's a bunch of stuff that's happened, all that sort of accumulated in the release of their record, which is called All at Once. John, what do you want to say about the screaming females? And to emphasize how much I think you're going to talk about this, I'm going to open this beer.
The new album is excellent, and it is precisely what the band needed to do at this point in time, if you ask me. Last album, Rose Mountain, was fantastic. It was 10 tracks. All the tracks were relatively short, very riff-heavy, very energetic, and it was a rocker. It was a total rocker. This album rocks, but it's not a rocker. It really is a classic double album in that, like, the band is a whole bunch of different things. The songs are huge sounding, a lot of mid-tempo stuff, and I don't usually like mid-tempo stuff, but this is good mid-tempo stuff. One of the most interesting things about this is Marissa Paternoster, the singer. Wow, her voice, it just gets better and better and better. And so I will say this album is not as savage as previous screaming females tracks, but I found this album to be incredibly moving. I think screaming females now for me are what like Kate Bush is for people. Like I found the whole album incredibly touching, but not milquetoast, not weak. It's a very strong, powerful album, but soulful, moving. It really speaks to the heart, if you will, but it also speaks to the brain in that, you know, Marissa's lyrics are very abstract, very Dolly-esque, if you will. And meanwhile, Jarrett and Mike, drummer and bassist respectively, they really bring the thunder and the heat. I think it's really interesting how the band has been able to merge soulful, moving stuff while keeping the real heavy-duty thwomp in the music. There's some real weird stuff here. I think the opening track, Glass House, is one of the best songs they've ever written. I think their song called Bird in Space is really, really neat. It's real trippy. It's far out. I got the demos disc with it and the 7-inch with it that has the covers. The demos disc is really cool, and the songs are very, very different. The covers, 7-inch, is real cool too. That was previously released on the AV Club. But I just think the most important thing here is how great the Screaming Females are at writing songs, actually writing unique, interesting songs. How amazingly talented they all are. How amazingly talented Marissa is at singing, and just how this album is bold. I would say Glass House is a huge single, but I don't know if there's any, like, you know, tight, compact snappers like Wishing Well from Rose Mountain. But this is the kind of album that you can just do over and over and over and not get tired of it, because it's so massive, it's so expansive, it's so interesting that it's always there. And it's not that it's always there, that there's always something new to find and interesting about this record. It's four sides, and I find that each side kind of acts as its own unit. So you don't have to listen to it all at once, like, or all the way through. Like, each side is kind of its own little piece. And I think for this band, this was the move to make, and I think they executed it phenomenally.
I'll just get mine out of the way, because I know this is an Adam and John band. I actually did listen to this album. I always give them a chance. For me, it sort of dragged, and I'm not saying it like it was bad or anything like that. I just, there were parts where that just sort of dragged for me. But I got to tell you, you're talking about what the single should have been. That song, I'll Make You Sorry, is a fucking killer song. Like, that guitar riff, that great guitar interlude, that solo that turns into an interlude. And I happen to agree, I think her voice is super interesting. She kind of has like these weird vibratos that I really like in that song, especially. But that's that. I think it's a little bit poppier than the rest. So yeah, I think this band's starting to grow on me. But yeah, if you're not into this band, check out that song. It's really good.
The selling point for me on Screaming Females early on was Marissa's voice, and which is, I mean, is unlike, I think, most other. I can't figure out like who's a contemporary vocalist that sounds like her right
no,
now.
I was like, the closest I can think of is like Patti Smith, but that's only because they each have like unique voices, and like she always gets compared to Patti Smith because she covered Patti Smith. So you don't want to compare her to Patti Smith. Like, no, but she doesn't sound like anybody. You know?
Yeah, no, she's got more of a baritone than Patti Smith does. But and I think that like in this context, on this sort of like big expansive record where they're not too concerned with writing, you know, tight little singles or anything like that. It's spectacular. Like her vocals on this album are amazing.
Can I just pause you? How amazingly talented is Marissa? Like, she can sing and play guitar like a maniac. Like, how many people can do that? You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I'll, you know what? I'm going to, I'll get to my, the moment that sold me on her in a second. But the, I know when we talked about the single to this, when it first showed up, I was a little bit unsure because it didn't have that big hook in it. And I think thankfully what I assumed was going to happen with this record has happened, which is that as a cohesive piece, that this record completely works for me. It's engaging. I enjoy it. I don't find it boring or slow. And while it's more mid tempo, say, than some of the stuff on Rose Mountain, it's not boring. So I'm all for what they're doing here. And I think that, like, within sort of their wider catalog and them having, you know, written basically whole records that are, you know, chock full of hits, right? Because you talk about, like, Rose Mountain is like fucking like one single after another, right? That this completely works. I think it's a great record. I think it's going to be a grower for a lot of people because it has the depth that I think you could listen to this for the better part of the year and, you know, be more in love with it by the time you get to the end of the year. So that's good. All things are looking good here. No, but what sold me on Marissa's vocals, and maybe the first time that I had heard her, was the, what's it called? The AV Club's cover series.
Mm. Oh, the Taylor Swift one.
The Taylor Swift one, right? Where she went on and did this cover of Taylor Swift's Shake It Off, which, you know, A, was completely striking because her voice is nothing, right? Like Taylor's. So when I first heard it, that was the first time I'd ever heard Marissa's voice. It was like, holy shit, this little person behind like a mop of black hair, you know, has this incredible, you know, incredibly like depth to her voice. But outside of that, she's like, she puts this like completely ripping solo into that song too. And that was what sold me on going and checking the rest of this band out, because I'm just like, wow. Like they went in and they did what I like. If you gave, you know, a big pop mega hit like that to, you know, any, let's say, pop punk band, they would take it and do something stupid with it. They would either make it really dumb and goofy by playing it like a hardcore song, or they would make it, they'd play it in this, you know, middle of the road pop punk tempo, where the joke is that it is a pop punk song. You know, that it's the same fucking thing that like all of those pop goes punk records and all that stuff do. Basically any cover of any song from like 1993 until 2002, any of that shit, it would have been one of those. But they went and they took that song and they did something amazing with it. And I don't know. That's what kind of sold me on it. So, I mean, speaking of that, John, we have to segue right into another one of those covers, because
yes, it's
popped up over the past week in the lead up to this record as well. So, what was the song that they had covered?
Marissa covered from the Eurythmics. What's her name? The female from the Eurythmics. Oh, I forgot her name. Walking on Broken Glass. Annie Lennox. She covered Annie Lennox's song No More I Love Yous. And wow. I was like, holy, I actually didn't know that song too well. I just heard the Screaming Females version. And I was like, oh my God, this song is amazing. Like, I was moved again. I don't know what it is about Paternoster, but every time I listen to the Bad Canoes moves me differently. But every time I listen to the Screaming Females, I'm like, I'm so emotional. Like, I feel this. I'm one with the universe, you know? I feel joy and regret all at once blending into this single, you know, singularity of human emotion and existence, you know, true connectivity. I'm like wow she's really speaking to me. I'm like, maybe Annie Lennox is like really, really great. And I listen like the Annie Lennox version and it's like really boring. It's like really, well, see, it's like very 80s and really boring. And it goes to show how she can elevate, like Marissa's hope, she can elevate stuff or find what is really special about it and magnify it and cut away everything that's not necessary.
I did not initially recognize the Annie Lennox song until the chorus clicked in, and then suddenly it just flooded back that, like, oh, when I was like, you know, 8, this was the kind of thing that was on the radio station that my mom listened to.
Yeah, man,
right? Like, it was one of those tracks. So But yeah, it was also cool. So yeah, lots of love from us, I guess, for the screaming females and what they're doing.
Are you as moved by her music as I am, or not? You can say no. Like, I'm moved by the screaming females. Moved. I'm like driving, I'm wiping a tear from my eye, you know, I'm looking over the mountain ridges on the highway, you know.
Not to that degree, but I could get there. It is more, it is less so, it's probably more that I just haven't, like, you know, haven't been driving into the mountains with it blaring out of my face.
I don't know what it is. It really does speak to my soul. One other thing I want to address quickly, and I don't want to sour the conversation. Why are people so mean to Marissa in the comment section? They're so mean to her, but like, why?
You know, they're just mean to her as a proxy for you.
You think that's what it is?
I think it is. I think that there's a certain stripe of the comment section that's decided that you're their enemy for, I don't know, for helping maintain the website that they hang out on.
I don't get it either.
You know, just because I'm not like the biggest fan of this band, even if I wasn't on the staff, it wouldn't occur to me just to take shots at people for no reason. I have things to do.
Like she's so talented and is so accomplished, but she's not it's not like she's like an asshole like Ben Weasel or something. Like, she's so harmless. It's like, why are you attacking Marissa of all people? I just don't understand it.
There are other musicians that garner the same hate when we post about them from time to time as well. I think we had some. Maybe we should just compile a list and see what the.
I mean, honestly, how they're the same. I want to not post about screaming females just because I don't want to subject Marissa to like that meanness. But on the other hand, it's like, well, does that mean the thugs are winning? You know what I mean?
That's exactly what it means. And if there's legitimate news about a band, regardless of what the cancer in the comments, you know, shit on, it's still news. News is news, whether it's good or bad. Fuck you. That's it.
You're right, Ricky. That's exactly what I needed to hear. You're right.
We're not, and that's the other thing that I wanted to say. We're not like good news punk. We're not good punk news. We're not positive punk news. We just post the shit that we collect and post it on there. We're not trying to push any sort of like a weird agenda or like make sure like we don't post something or that we need to post another something from a certain label or whatever. It's whatever we get. And I don't care what the people in the comments say. It's just news. It's not good or bad or neutral. It's just we put out what we have. That's it.
Well said, Ricky.
Thank you.
It's only rock and roll and Ricky likes it. Okay. So yeah.
This is not rock and roll at all. This next article.
Yeah. Yeah, anyway, so, all right, so every year, Record Store Day has ambassadors that act as focal points for the event. This year, the ambassadors for Record Store Day are going to be Run the Jewels, the hip-hop duo of Killer Mike and LP. RSD 2018 is happening on April 21st this year. There is a little video that you can go check on Punk News in which the Run the Jewels guys, promo for Record Store Day. John, what does being the Record Store Day ambassador mean?
All it means is that you're willing to stand there for a couple of videos and say you should go to Record Store Day and record stores in general. I mean, the duties probably are one afternoon and maybe do a couple of interviews, you know, over the next 4 months or so. That's the extent of the, you know, and you retweet shit from your Twitter.
Yeah, okay.
All right, can I make this better? Because I can make this better.
Okay.
I don't know why people don't come to me to make stuff better, but I'm going to make stuff better. So that, can we all agree that despite our feelings on Record Store Day or our feelings on Run the Jewels, that's kind of lame?
Yeah. See, I was going to ask before John talked about what they do, what like ambassadors do, whether it's, you know, Chuck D or Run the Jewels or Metallica or Jack White. I gotta tell you, I am always on the Record Store Day podcast. I love Record Store Day. I don't get this. I don't know why, I don't know why Metallica needs to represent Record Store Day. I it's
Oh, I disagree 100%.
It's not bad or good. I just don't care.
It's just marketing, right? But here, I can make this entirely. I can make this way better and credible.
Please do.
By switching out the word. Don't make them the ambassadors of Record Store Day. Make them the curators of Record Store Day, right?
Yeah, but that implies... Go ahead. I'm sorry, Adam.
So I'm not saying they have to curate everything. But so there's music festivals that do this, right? What's it called?
There was a big one in All Tomorrow's Parties was curated.
All Tomorrow's Parties does this. There's one up in Calgary called Sled Island that does it. Basically, the people that organize the festival still end up booking most of the bands. But what the curator will do is they'll come in and they'll slot in, say, two or three bands into that lineup that they know, you know, represent whatever they're trying to get across or whatever they find artistically interesting. So, you know, have 98% of Record Store Day happen as it would, but have your curators put together, you know, two or three really choice releases. It doesn't even need to be their releases. It could be stuff that they like dug up out of the vaults, right? But basically, like you as the Record Store Day company has to, you know, commit to, you know, okay, if Killer Mike comes to you and says, you know, I as part of this, I want you to burn. You didn't burn. Fuck. Yeah, I want you to press.
Make some CDRs and hand
make
the
some
parking
CDRs,
lot.
Right? No, but if Killer Mike comes to you and says, "Hey, as part of being the curator this year, I want you to press, you know, 150 copies of this speech that Bernie Sanders gave on the auto industry," then you do it because they're the curator and that's what they wanted, right? But and then all of a sudden, there's a little bit more like artistic credibility that's built into that outside of just the marketing role on it. That would make this better.
Adam,
that is my idea. I will take my $70,000 in PayPal.
Very wise, Adam. You could even put like little stickers on records and have them explain why that's like a special record to them or something. That's a great idea, Adam. Man, a lot of smart people on the podcast today.
Mm-hmm. Especially
Do we have any feelings about what the list will be? If it'll be good or bad?
Yes.
Last year for me was pretty good.
Oh, I thought it was pretty crappy last year, I think. But a lot of interesting David Bowie records coming out this year. David Bowie Let's Dance demo, but more interesting, unreleased live David Bowie record from 1978 featuring mainly his Berlin period stuff.
Oh, okay. Well, one of my favorite stories of the year is when the list comes out, so I'm looking forward to that.
I don't have a whole ton of faith in the individual lists for Record Store Day. Like, I feel like a couple years ago, whatever year it was when they released the they did a pressing of Joe Strummer's Gangsterville. That was cool. I like that year, but the past couple have been like, you know, I'm not gonna
honestly, Adam,
I'm not getting off my ass.
I'm actually kind of liking it I think it's been way weaker the past 3 or 4 years. But I kind of like, because I used to be going and spending like $120-$140 and like paying $40 for a record. There's lately been like one thing that I want. I go and I get it and I'm happy, you know? So
last year was, I think, my biggest haul because I got that Ramones box set. And a couple LPs too. Forgetting which ones at the moment.
Adam, you remember Scott Heisler used to spend like $400.
Oh, Scott. Scott lives in a different universe, though. I don't know.
Man,
I think Scott could leave his house and go spend $400 on like random CDs at places. It's just Scott's ability to find and acquire things is amazing.
Last year I only got two. I got two LPs, the Ramones box set, and then 2 7-inches. That's my biggest haul. But
so you spent $375.
Nowhere near it. Not no way. No way.
That's a Record Store Day joke, Ricky.
Oh, jokes aren't landing today, guys.
Yeah. So okay, we're gonna talk about a handful of music festival news, all of which is Canadian, coincidentally, or at least that's the way I've stacked it. So, first of all, the full list of bands playing Poozafest 2018 have been announced. The lineup now includes bands like Face to Face, Dead Fucking Last, Grimskunk, Debt Neglector, who Ricky just played a minute ago. And lots more, as previously announced on there, there's a Wilhelm Scream, Anti-Flag, Frankie Stubbs, Cancer Bats, Real Big Fish. There's a really gigantic lineup for this thing. So Pooza, if you've never been, happens May 18th to 20th. That's the May 2-4 long weekend if you're Canadian. And it goes on in downtown Montreal. It happens over a number of venues, very, very much similar to, say, like a fest kind of setup. And it is usually a mix of, you know, fest style punk bands and a bunch of cool kind of like local, you know, Montreal and Quebec area bands playing the smaller venues. And yes, that's what's going on. So you can go to, what is the website? Poozafest.com and find sort of the full lineup to this thing. There's a lot, and I'm not going to reiterate them all here. The one thing that I think is interesting about Pooza's lineup this year, and I'm curious what you guys have to say about this in particular. When you look at their lineup, like the poster for their lineup, the top band on this thing is Real Big Fish. Like their name is big and at the top of it. And yeah. I don't mean to say that like festivals need a big giant ass headliner, because I would say just the opposite, but it's strange to me that they're giving Real Big Fish that billing.
You know, I agree. I think probably Face to Face should be up there. Or maybe Anti-Flag, but I think Face to Face maybe Real Big Fish has a bigger following up there.
I think Anti-Flag is the most famous in the United States. I wouldn't say Face to Face is. I do think it's funny. This is like one of those like weird European festivals where it'll have like Downtown Boys headlining like Friday, and then Saturday it's like Disturbed or something, you know?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, we're not. Europe is fucking bonkers. I mean, usually the Canadian festivals at least sort of make sense in how they're doing it. And like, hey, I was a third wave ska kid. I have a lot of affinity for early Real Big Fish records. Don't get me wrong. And I know that Montreal had a huge third wave ska scene, but is today's Real Big Fish that kind of a draw? Like, I would have assumed that you would have like put Face to Face and Anti-Flag at the top of this. If not, I mean, like they're number two and three, if you're going by the visual order of it. So they're not far off, but you know, it's curious to me that they're up there. I guess I'm surprised that many people care about Real Big Fish these days.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was going to say, I was at, I think it was that East Scallywag, the first one that in San Diego, a year, maybe 2 years ago, and they were on the bill, but they were nowhere near the top. They're probably in the middle.
I wonder if we talked about Sublime with Rome on the last episode, and I wonder if they fall into that category where they're a draw. Like I think that like if you were going to go to Pooza because you wanted to go see
Sublime with Rome.
No. If you went to Pooza because you wanted to see, I'm going to go like grab a random band from the list here. Okay. Cause you wanted to go see Brutal Youth, right? Which is a cool band. Ricky likes them. But if you know about Brutal Youth and you're going to go see them at a festival, you don't care who's at the top of the bill anyways. That doesn't affect you. You're going to go see Brutal Youth, right? And that applies to, I think, a lot of the bands that are on a festival like this. So maybe by sticking Real Big Fish up on the top, that's bringing in, you know, a certain, say, like, not seen person that may not have otherwise gone to the festival in the first place. And it's actually going to move tickets in a reasonable way. Whereas, you know, the lower bands on the bill, the smaller bands on the bill, you know, aren't going to pull from that sort of radio rock crowd. Like, I guess it kind of goes like that, but.
Well, yeah, I mean, and, you know, I'm just looking at the lineup, which I'm very jealous of. I mean, the top bands I could go with or without. But I mean, Chick Stigget's playing this. That's cool. And Get Dead, yeah, and Wilhelm Scream, like and Brutal.
Yeah,
for me, it's the lower tier, like quote unquote lower tier bands that are playing this. That's all I'm all about.
I gotta say,
oh yeah, and that's you'd go.
There are some real left field picks here, which I approve of. I mean, I'm not gonna notice this, but like DFL is kind of like DFL is awesome, but I'm like,
yeah,
like these,
like the, part, and they're part kind of me, the Ricky, lineup too.
They're There's you know, a lot of like Epiphat bands and a lot of Fest style bands, and it's like also DFL. It's like, whoa. It's like DFL is not in that general area at all. I think there's like, oh, and also like MU330. So there's a lot of like very surprising picks here in that are just kind of wedged in between the other ones. So I you know.
Yeah, John, your band, the Up Up Ups, are playing.
They are. They are. I'm very happy for them.
Your pals in Tsunami Bomb are playing it. I mean, like, there's a lot of depth on this lineup. Like, War on Women are there. Who else am I? Who else just popped out? You know, Sincere Engineer, the new Red Scare band.
Arms Aloft.
Yeah, Arms Aloft, Pew Pew Pew. I mean, there's lots of cool stuff on this thing, so you should go check it out. Pusa is always a good time, and Montreal is a cool city to go see a bunch of bands play in for a few days. So, you know, go to Pusa if you have a chance to go to Pusa. It's a cool time. Now, there's a couple other things that have been announced festival-wise. This is a new thing for me. Well, not really. I mean, it's a new thing for me in the past couple years is... As I've gone like further down into my like weird Canadian music thing, this journey that I'm on here, I've started buying passes to go to festivals pre-lineup.
Daring.
Which is not something that the old Adam would have done. With the full expectation that like I won't know these bands, but I like the kind of stuff that plays this festival. So I'm sure if I go, it will be cool. It'll be like a cool discovery thing. So I did that last year with like Ottawa Explosion. I bought that pass before they had any lineup announced. And then again, once it was announced, I'm like, I know a handful of these bands, but you know, I'll figure it out. And I spent a lot of the time before the show sort of like going band by band through the list and going like, what's on this that's cool. And then I want to go check out while I'm there. I did that kind of thing with FME last year, although, I mean, I was there, you know, quote unquote working because I was covering it. But this year, this morning I bought a couple passes for my wife and I to go to Sappy Fest, which is a festival that happens in Sackville, New Brunswick, out on the East Coast.
Oh, Canada. I think it was in New Brunswick, New Jersey. I'm like, Adam, I'll come up and meet you, but no.
No. Like the province of New Brunswick. And so Sappy is in this like tiny little college town, that's like, you know, 40 minutes out of Moncton, if anyone knows where Moncton is. And you know, I've never been, but I know people that go religiously year on year and they love it. And it's one of these things that like you go to this festival and then you're delighted by learning what bands they book eventually. Right. So, you know, roll the dice on this one because that's going to involve a flight and everything. But I'm sure it'll pay off. So, yeah, I'm going to Sappy. So if any of our Punk News Podcast listeners happen to be in New Brunswick and want to come hang out with me in August, you can do that. The other fest that I just mentioned, Ottawa Explosion, they just announced their. They've announced the first kind of like three bands that are playing. The Ottawa Explosion weekend, which happens in June of this year, June 13th to 17th. This is going to be the eighth year for that festival. They've just announced three so far, but there's going to end up being like 70 bands on this lineup by the time they're done. They have a band out of the UK called Martha that, I'd never heard, but is super cool when I sat down and listened to them. The LA band, Peach Kelly Pop, and the Ottawa act, the White Wires, hometown heroes, the White Wires are playing this thing. So that was just the first three that they've announced, but this is going to be another one of these that as soon as the tickets go on sale, I'm like, I'm going to go buy tickets to that. And I'm sure it'll be cool when I get there. And I almost like doing that more right now than having to worry about these like roll of dice, not roll of dice, but like we're worrying about these like wishy-washy shitty festivals where I got to like look at the lineup and go like, oh, do I like any of these bands? Like I'm thinking back to like when I used to go to Warp Tours back when I was young, where I'd have to like, you know, you wait for the Warp Tour lineup and then you see which bands are coming to your city and you see if there are any of your favorite bands are coming there so you can go see them. And it's like, this is so different to operate this way where it's just like, you know, I want to go listen to music for 3 days and I want it to be cool. So I'm going to find someone that I like trust to curate that and make that happen. And I just get out of my own way and stop trying to just like go see bands I know. So yeah, that's what I'm doing.
Nice.
Yeah. Very so cool. Anyways, this is a song by White Wires called Ontario Life, appropriately. It was off a compilation that they released that they were a part of in 2011 that was on the Mammoth Cave label that was called Bloodstains Across Ontario. So this is the song Ontario Life by White Wires out of Ottawa. We're back. That was White Wires. John, you put this next story together.
This is a me article. I did it for me. I didn't do it for the readers. I did it for me. Mad Magazine is going to reboot after 549 issues. Mad Magazine is going to revert to issue number one and move from the East Coast to the West Coast. Editor John Ficar, who's been there for 30 years, is retiring, and the magazine will now be steered by Bill Morrison, who's done other magazines. It's the end of an era with a lot of magazines. We're seeing it's the end of an era. Fun fact about John G interned at Mad Magazine in college.
Did you really?
I did. And I knew John Ficarra. I knew longtime editor Dave Rayola. I knew longtime editor. I can't remember the art department guy, and also Joe Rayola and Dave Corrado. They were the other two main editors. There was another editor there. A lady, her name was Lisa something, but she's been gone for a long time. It was an eye-opening experience. New York's a lot tougher than a lot of areas, and Mad Magazine is cool. I like Mad Magazine a lot. I'm sad to see it, such a rapid or severe change of what it is, but that's what happens. I mean, it's been owned by DC for about 40 years now. It's tough for Mad Magazine because when Mad hell from 1952 to like 1998, if you wanted comedy, you'd get Mad Magazine. But now the internet is Mad Magazine. You know what I mean? Memes are Mad Magazine. So it's tough to exist in that space, which is too bad. I love Mad Magazine. What was funny is when I interned there, I had a good time. But I think the concept of Mad Magazine is this wacky, crazy place. Mad Magazine is not this wacky, crazy place. It's pretty serious. I mean, it's a magazine, That's why I put this article.
Up. So I don't have any particular fond memories of Mad or anything like that. It wasn't something that I loved as a kid.
I still do love it.
But outside of the personnel who were running it retiring, I suppose this sort of fits into the whole move of DC Comics. They were famously, based in New York, same as Marvel was for years and years and years. But they in the past year, I think, sort of packed up the DC offices, and they moved everything to the West Coast to really be closer to Warner Brothers. And I guess really the driving force behind that was the incredible import that the movies have taken as far as money-making ventures in the superhero world, right? So with how much money superhero movies are making, the companies that own all these comic publications and things like that are using them increasingly as the the breeding ground for intellectual property that they're going to turn around and make films out of. So a big part of that was to, you know, shift DC's offices all out to the West Coast so they could kind of be out in Hollywood land and, you know, closer to that. It hasn't really benefited them with their particular films.
I mean, the DC movies are so bad, Adam. They're so bad.
Yeah, but anyway, so they're out there now. So as they're out there, you know, I guess it makes sense that this incarnation of MAD is going to be born as a West Coast thing too, because that's where they've consolidated their troops is out there.
MAD magazine is where I first got professionally published. I had one panel published in the magazine in 2005. I just realized, or maybe that is the first time I ever got professionally published. I got paid $25.
You can go to five shows back then.
Yeah, you're right. the summer of 2005, Adam.
No, when you say one panel,
one panel, they had this starting right around then. They had this page called the Kundalini Pages, which was like one or two panel gags, and I had a one panel gag in there. So I lived at the Jewish YMCA at 91st and Lexington. I would walk down to 56th and Broadway. Spend $1.50 for lunch, walk back, spend 89 cents on a water ice on the way back, and basically read, because I had no TV, no computer. This was before like laptops. Well, not before laptops, before everybody had a laptop. In the weekends, I would go to the museums, and that was my summer, Adam. Walking between 91st and 56th, getting water ice and going to the museums and going to Mad Magazine and working with two other interns, one guy which was cool and one person which was just, whew, rough.
John, none of us can live your amazing life. All right, we have to move on. This next story is yours, so I'm just going to let you.
Oh, okay, I just wanted. I realize the Punk News podcast is a audio program, so I want you to go on to the Punk News website and check out the following article: Davidians to go on hiatus. The Davidians are the punk band. They haven't been around that long. That includes Brian Walsby on drums. Brian Walsby has been a bunch of bands, including Double Negative, which has somewhat of a cult following. He's probably more famous as an artist. He did Walk Together, Rock Together cover by 7 Seconds. He did the Nardcore Comp album cover. He does a bunch of art for the Melvins. Actually, if you have any of those bifocal media t-shirts, he's done a bunch of them. He's done them for the Descendants. He's done them for 7 Seconds. He's done them for Melvins. He's done them for Jell-O. He's done them for Keith Morris. Who's the other big bifocal media guy? Chris Sharry. So Chris Sharry and Brian Walsby are kind of the two big designers for bifocal media, at least a t-shirt wing. Anyways, so the band's going to go on hiatus. And the only reason I bring it, Brian Walsby basically said, listen, I'm old. No one cares about this band. We're just not doing it anymore. We're still friends. We just don't want to do it anymore. Which, the concept of punk rock is you should do it even if you have no fans, if it's all about yourself. Like art, if you care about art, that's what counts. But he's saying, listen, we can put our time into other things. No one cares. Why are we doing this? Which I think is interesting. But the real reason I wanted to post this is because he posted a picture announcing he's quitting the band. And I just think this picture is one of the funniest pictures I've ever seen. It's got him like as an old man carrying a drum, and he's like barely can hold it up. And it's got two kids, and one says, whoa. And the other kid says, yikes, that guy must be 1,000 years old. And it's very Mad Magazine-esque. And I think you should go look at this picture online because I think it's hilarious.
Nothing like describing a picture on a podcast. So, yeah.
Do you find this picture amusing, Adam? Do you think this is funny?
No, let me pull this up.
Nothing better than listening to someone look at pictures on a podcast.
Yep. I mean, it's funny as far as the story goes. It's not the greatest thing I've ever seen.
I don't know. I used to...
Like, I don't even have my retinas burned out now because I've seen all that can be seen by a human. You may be overhyping it a bit. It's fun.
I just like the guy's like, he must be 1,000 yeah. years old. And I like how his tongue's sticking out when he's cagging the drums. Maybe it's because I know him. I think it's funny. Screw you all. I hate you,
John.
All.
I am going to force you to pronounce this next.
Fun fact about. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. So, go ahead.
Yeah, hold on. Yeah, you can do it in a sec. So, there is a band from Greece. John is going to tell you their name in a minute. They have released a record called Out of Greece. in which they cover the majority of Minor Threat's discography. It's streaming right now on Punk News if you want to go check it out. It's super interesting. John, what is this band called, given that it is written in...
Well, Adam, do you know I actually know Coptic?
I do. Oh. from your time as
a... So I will read this in Coptic, not in Greece, which is almost the same pronunciation. So it would be Pinesha I don't know what that last letter is. That's not in Coptic. So it's like kind of like Pinesha Apeish or something like that. Or no, that's an R. So it would be a pair. Pinesha a pair. There you go, kids. That's my Greek.
So, anywho, John, where do we come across this? Like, how
I'll tell you, I'm very excited. We've got a whole bunch of new writers at Punk News, and honestly, they're all doing a great job. And one of them, Ionis, he's from Greece, and he lives in Greece. And I'm very excited that we've got someone living in Greece writing for Punk News. He made us aware of this, and I said, well, let's make an article out of this because it's just an interesting thing. We're international now, Adam. Well, we were always international because we had the Canada-U.S. connection and some British people. But now we got some people in Greece. And, well, actually, and Ronaldo's down in the Caribbean, so I guess he's international too. So I guess we've been international a while, but now we got somebody in Greece, which is nice.
So, yeah, so there's not too much to say about it. It's a Greek Minor Threat covers record, but it sounds cool. It's it comes off well in that tongue. I mean, I'll give it that.
You know, what I found kind of striking was they got like the guitar tone and everything with the instruments like pretty right on. I mean, they were as close as you probably could get.
You know what we should really do on this podcast? And I'm sure this will make Greg go crazy, is whenever we have any story about anything, we should play like 30 seconds of whatever we're talking about, 20 seconds, a chorus, you know, 5 seconds. So then people can go, oh, all right. And then we talk about it. We should do that. That'll make editing it take 6 hours longer than it already does. Write us at podcast@punknews.org if you want Greg to be subjected to that horribleness. So anyways, the final thing we want to talk about right now is that right now you can go over to NPR and you can stream the new Andrew WK record, which is called You're Not Alone. I think, John, you haven't heard this sucker yet. Me and Mr. Franco,
yes,
have. Although I'm pretty sure I have not heard. I think I've heard half of it. And then, you know, listening to an album streaming off a website is fraught in my life. So that didn't play entirely as I needed it to, but I think I got a feel for this. What's your thought, Ricky, on You're Not Alone?
I really enjoyed it. It's long. Like it's almost an hour long. But overall I thought it was great. I listened to it all the way through when the day the article went up. But I listened to a couple other just singles off it. But I really liked Music Is Worth Living For. And what was the other song I really liked? Oh, The Party Never Dies. Overall, I mean, yeah, this is a perfect record for Andrew WK diehard fans. Like, I don't know if it's enough for me to get like the vinyl or anything, but I enjoyed this quite a bit.
It's interesting how clearly this record sort of wears its message.
Yeah.
Where it, like, he is setting out to make people, I don't know, to talk people off the edge, right?
Yeah,
like that's
clearly a message.
Like that like you said it, like the single there, Music Is Worth Living For, mm-hmm. right? But like there's like little like spoken word interludes on this record, right, where he's like, I don't know, he's trying to like talk you off the brink. And I don't know, I haven't read any interviews with him about this. Like, I don't know what the exact motivation of that is. I mean, like a lot of people I think would, you know, they get this sense of joyousness from Andrew WK's output in general, but he is really taken to heart that, like, you know, I could write this record and it could convince someone not to kill themselves. So that's what I'm going to do. And it like explicitly is trying to do that at some points. So like on the one hand, you know, it's make you feel great listening to this because it's super positive and like aggressively positive in a way that I think few things try to be, few things strive to mm-hmm. be. It's very much like it's not ashamed of this mission that it set out for himself. Like it is not at all trying to be cool or anything. Like and I'm curious that like what's going on in Andrew's head as he put this together. And you know, did he put this together singing to him for himself? Did he put this together because, you know, there was someone in his life that needed it? Or is it just this general sense that, you know what, he could go write some super posy record and help someone in the world? Like the motivation behind putting this together, I think is sort of fascinating, but
yeah, I think it was for, you
know,
fans.
It's definitely worth listening.
I think it was for fans. Cause I know he was talking. Why do I think he was? He got some award from some.
He got an award from the
National Suicide Awareness thing, right?
He got the Person of the Year from the National Association of Suicidology, which is kind of a bad name, but the study of suicide, I guess. But they're an anti-suicide organization.
That's what I think the message was in this. I think this was for fans that just needed, you know, for lack of a better term, a pick me up.
I know it's so overt though.
Yeah.
Like it does not dress that up in metaphor. It does not have that as the goal, but is otherwise trying to be, you know, a traditional rock and roll record. Like it is quite plainly at some points being like, do not kill yourself.
The album is called You're Not Alone.
I know, I mean, like it is so overt that it's striking in how overt that this thing's
been. I will say, this is not a unique phenomenon that, you know, NKWK has overwhelmingly, in a good way, an overwhelmingly positive message. You know, let's party, let's have it a good time. People that often are like, yeah, like just be super positive, often in my experience, actually often have very dark thoughts. And that's why they express the positive side outwardly, because it is how they kind of deal with it. And so people that honestly often like express like one emotion outwardly often have the opposite emotion that they keep to themselves. You know, another example, I like Andrew WK a lot, and I think that's a fascinating aspect of him. And I'm interested, maybe I'll reach out to do an interview with him if he's down. That'd be a very interesting interview to have. But like people that are always like, you know, treat everybody fair, let's be nice, those people are usually that like say, oh, you know, like I'm disgusted that people aren't fair and nice to other people. Disgusted. Those people are usually people that aren't very fair and aren't very nice in my experience. The point being is that when someone exhibits one emotion to a very large scale, they often have the opposite emotion in their private life, or they're fighting against that in their head, if you will.
Yeah, so this is I think it's worth going to listen to. Even if you're not an Andrew WK fan, just to experience what he's trying to do here. Like it is a very mission oriented record.
Andrew WK is so cool. I think he's so, like, I think he's really cool, but are we buying on the hype train, or really, is he really that cool? And I kind of think he really is that cool.
I got to tell you, after seeing him, I think he is.
Agree. Cool. Yeah, you're right. You got to see him live. That's it. That you're right.
Yeah. Yeah, and I got to, I've not seen him, his solo show, but his, goddamn, the full band is just fucking massive, and that'll, if you're not an Andrew WK fan, seeing him live will change your mind to the polar opposite.
Agreed.
So
that's what's all we got. That's where we're stopping right now. John, do you have anything you want to play for the people before we
roll out? Steve Ignorant actually just put out a live album, and it's really cool. It's him doing Crass songs, Conflict songs, Schwarzenegger songs, Dirt songs, and even Flux of Pink Indians. So let's listen. It's called, 32, 1984 or something. It's his new live album with Paranoid Visions. You can find it that way. Let's listen to a track from that. Let's listen to him doing, how about Tube Disasters, a cover of Flux of Pink Indians. This is Steve Ignorant and Paranoid Visions covering Tube Disasters. And you should get this record. It's real cool.
Back with Steve Ignorant with Paranoid Visions. John, Anything else you want to tell people, or should they buy tickets?
I was going to say Andrew WK is right. Don't commit suicide. It probably won't. Well, who knows if it'll make any difference at all? But let's just give people the National Suicide Awareness or like the Help Me phone line right now. How about that? Not a bad thing to do. You guys talk. I'm going to look up that number right now.
Good.
Okay, don't talk and wait for me to.
This is a weird thing to have to.
1-800-273-8255. 1-800-273-8255. So if you're having a real bad day and you need somebody to talk to, you should call that number. I support that 100%. Any other last positive things? The new Steve Ignorant record is awesome. Come to my event. It will be a good time. $7 to $10. If you can't afford $7, shoot me an email and we'll work something out. Drew Getz, Crazy in the Brains, Jade from Posers, and Up Up Ups, and it is going to be awesome. I'm getting the exclusive cassette put together just for the show. I'm getting the boxing program put together for the show. It is going to be a humdinger. You can find it on Facebook just by putting in Up Up Ups and Crazy in the Brains, or you can get tickets at Eventbrite.com. April 7, baby. It'll be awesome.
This has been a Velour Underground production. I am Greg Simpson, producer of this podcast. Hit me up if you want me to mix, master, or produce your podcast, even from afar. Or, you got a band you want to come record with me in scenic Lafayette, Indiana? Let's do it. Hit me up at greg@velourundergroundstudios.com.